the races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two at the races, and an early visit from Jay Privman, and a perfect scenario recap Santa Anita and the big three-day weekend that started the autumn meet and Preakness. We're set now with the field of 11. Jay, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent, and looking forward to Saturday. Really a fun scenario with an all-stakes card, and it's been such a long, strange trip, Jay.
Yes, it has. It's been just the whole year has been crazy, and there's still more to come, I'm sure, with the Breeders' Cup being run under similar circumstances to the Kentucky Derby. So, but we're looking forward to, like you said, this weekend, wrapping up this unusual Triple Crown. And the races last week at Santa Anita were terrific. We've got good racing coming up at Santa Anita. And obviously Pimlico Saturday, and Belmont's going to have a great card Saturday, though. So there's a lot of good stuff going on right now.
You know, one of the things that when you say that, you mention, you know, the next challenge weekend with all the Breeders' Cup winning your in races, and you got the ARC coming up as well, and so forth. It, one thing that, you know, I think people were kind of surprised about, Jay, was when they saw the Preakness field released yesterday about 12:15, 12:20, and they saw all of the local Mid-Atlantic, you know, MJC track jockeys that were riding. And, you know, people were like, well, where's the Ortizes? Where's Rosario? And so I put up the schedule of races at Keeneland and Belmont and Santa Anita and said, you know, it's a pretty big weekend elsewhere. These are unique circumstances.
Right. I mean, unless you're on one of the top contenders in that race, you know, there's just so many other opportunities, like you said, with Keeneland opening this weekend and the races at Belmont and Santa Anita. Those guys are going to have multiple mounts and races that are not only important that day, but are potentially going to be important for Breeders' Cup weekend too. So I think unless you're on one of the, you know, the favorites in the Preakness, you could see why they'd be staying home and not just taking a ride to take, you know, to ride some sort of 15 or 20 to 1 shot and take a shot that day.
And even though it's, you know, it's on Saturday, I do want to start with the Preakness, Jay, and then we got a lot more to flesh out. So let's talk about your thoughts coming out of Derby, and you know, the other element of this has been a 4-week spread. So, you know, the usual Preakness issues of, you know, the quick turnaround and so forth are not nearly as much in play. The involvement of Swiss Skydiver and Art Collector obviously make this, you know, a pretty fascinating assembly, really.
It really is. It's a much more interesting race than it often is when it's 2 weeks after the Derby, and if you've got an emphatic Derby winner and not too many challenge that horse, and a lot of them lay in wait for the Belmont 5 weeks later. But this is really the last opportunity for three-year-olds on the dirt in a Grade 1 race going long against three-year-olds only this year. So otherwise you're running against older horses, or you can look at something like the Malibu at 7/8, but that's, you know, December 26th.
Right.
So if you want to go along against three-year-olds only on dirt in a Grade 1, this is the last chance. It's really kind of, because of where it is on the calendar, it's kind of replacing where the Pennsylvania Derby often is, not this specific weekend, but this time of year in the fall. And I think that's one of the reasons the field has come up as strong as it has, and why it's maybe as a big a field as it is. It's because you've got it's that opportunity. But at the top, it's really good. Obviously, you've got the Derby winner, who's got an overall stellar record. He only He's only lost once, and it was to Honor AP, who's a high class, obviously a high class member of this division before his retirement. And then you've got Art Collector getting back in action after his ill-timed injury prior to the Derby, and just from watching tapes of his works from Churchill, it looks to me like he's bounced right back and is sitting on a big race Saturday, so I would expect him to be a really tough customer. And then Swiss Skydiver certainly adds intrigue to the race. She ran well behind Art Collector in the Bluegrass Stakes, and she's just made of hickory. I mean, she's been sent all over the country, and she fires every time. You wonder at some point, is this all going to finally catch up to her? But it hasn't yet. And off of her race in the Bluegrass, she certainly deserves a shot in this field, too. So it makes for a really good race.
A couple of thoughts. Let's maybe start. Start with Authentic coming back and trying to maybe put a bow and a stranglehold on 3-year-old championship with a win Saturday.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. There's a horse called Tis the Law out there who's going to be coming back in the Breeders' Cup Classic, and depending on how he does there. I mean, certainly Authentic has the upper hand at the moment on a head-to-head matchup, but there's still a few miles to travel here, and Tis the Law is skipping this race to point for the Breeders' Cup, which is good, which is going to be a tough assignment for a 3-year-old. But it's still, I wouldn't say that if Authentic wins Saturday that divisional race is over. That's the context I'm wanting to put that in. But it would certainly make him the leader in the clubhouse heading into the Breeders' Cup. That's for sure. If he were to win that race, my biggest concern, as I've said so often with Authentic, is I'm worried this distance is too short, because obviously it's wrong about him being able to get the mile and a quarter. So certainly the mile and 3/16 will be just fine for him. With 4 weeks instead of two, it's probably beneficial to him, but it's beneficial to the others as well. Bringing Derby winners back in the Preakness on 2 weeks rest has never been a detriment for Baffert. He's all five of his previous Derby winners who ran back on 2 weeks rest in the Preakness won the Preakness.
The difference, or the challenge, not a difference, but the challenge, looking at the way this field came together, is that there's not going to be, not that Authentic got a, quote unquote, got away with any kind of easy fractions, and just the opposite. In fact, I think we've all pretty much come to understand. Certainly, those that didn't in the immediate aftermath of the race, he kind of just gutted them in the Derby and went fast early and slow late. But it was just him and Tis the Law at that point. There's Authentic pace pressure that's going to come from inside, and maybe some pneumatic stalking pressure. Not that he's going to keep up necessarily with Authentic early, but he's not going to drop too far out of it either. What's your pace scenario in here, Jay, with Art Collector and Swiss Skydiver wants to be forward? Paco Lopez will be aggressive on Max Player, not that he's got the big speed. And then there's the matter of Thousand Words putting the blinkers on off of the Shared Belief win.
Yeah, I would not think that Max Player doesn't have the kind of speed to matter early. I wouldn't think that Thousand Words would be challenging his stablemate early.
No.
So let's dismiss with those. Art Collector is a legitimate front-running, pace pressure, lead or stock kind of horse. And, both his and King Guillermo's defections the week of the Kentucky Derby were extremely beneficial to the subsequent chances of Authentic by Derby Day. And I think we're among the, reasons to contribute to Authentic being able to stay the mile and a quarter 3.5 weeks ago. So, Art Collector to me is the most significant part of that equation. I'd also think that, New York Traffic is going to be right up there as well. he's got a rider change, and I would think that he's going to be put into the race. That's his best chance as well. So, but Art Collector is the most significant of the, you know, new faces to be going up against Authentic by far, in my opinion.
No, agreed, and you know, it's obviously. You know, there's no need to call it his Derby. The Preakness is a standalone classic in its own right. But for Tommy Drury, it's obviously an important opportunity.
For sure. I mean, you just were heartbroken for the connections for the what happened with the Kentucky Derby. You know, for Tommy Drury, for Brian Hernandez, Bruce Lunsford. You know, all of them. Looked like they had a horse who was going to be no worse than the third choice, if not the second choice in the Derby, and he just happened to get a minor injury whose timing was horrible. If it had happened a week or two earlier, he would have made the race, but the week that it happened, what with the treatment that needed to be done medically, you're out. And, you know, he's, like I said a few moments ago, just having watched tapes of his breezes since he's gone back into training, he looks to me like he's picked right up where he left off. So I would expect him to run big Saturday.
Flesh out some of the other scenarios in here, and some of the horses that you know, as you looked at this field, the way it lines up catches your eye and might figure into, you know, your own betting approach, because you've been known to put down a shekel or two.
Yes. It does drive the economy of the game, is our wagering. So I do very much enjoy that aspect of it. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm partial to Mr. Big News. You know, he was a horse that I thought had a real good look to get into the gimmicks at the Derby, and he came through. You know, unfortunately, my opinion at the top of the race was not as good, and so I couldn't really take advantage of it as much as would have liked to have, but I thought he had a compromised trip in the Bluegrass, and he certainly ran a big race in the Derby. It was a point, you know, nearing the quarter pole where he thought for a split second like he might even win the race the way he was moving. So it would not surprise me to see him come back and perform well again. I think there's a few others in here who are, you know, obviously taking shots and just aren't quite at this level at the moment. But he, to me, stepped up and showed that he's there right now.
Agreed. I looked at you know, the Asmussen players, and when I juxtaposed the morning line, Pneumatic kind of wormed his way into my thinking at 20-1.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be 20-1. I do think he has a shot to get into the gimmicks of the. Yeah. I liked his. He hasn't run against this caliber of horses with success yet, but he's a progressive horse. He's still, you know, fairly lightly raced, and he seems to just be taking steps forward every time. So I could certainly see him running the best race of his career Saturday. Whether that's good enough is another matter. I don't know that he's quite at the level of Authentic and Art Collector at this stage of the game, but he's certainly headed the right direction. He absolutely deserves, you know, this opportunity to run against, like I said, this is the last shot to go long against three-year-olds only on dirt in a grade one this year. So it certainly makes sense that he's been managed this way, that they didn't jam him back quickly and in the Derby, and they took their time to train him into this race to give him his best shot.
New York traffic became a little bit of a, you know, a fancy element going into Derby, and you know, he kind of chased and meekly backed out. You mentioned the rider change. There were people that were taking, you know, one side or the other when it came to the Haskell and trying to figure out, you know, how to approach those two. Does New York traffic get any kind of a mulligan in here, and how does he be successful in this race? What has to happen, Jay?
Yeah, I don't know that the race comes up good for him, and that's a really good point, because he's going to be chasing probably some real high-class speed that can keep going in authentic and art collectors. So he has to hope that they maybe soften one another up, you know, which would be hard to imagine writers as smart as John Velasquez and Brian Hernandez engaging in a battle that compromises both of them. You know, and he needs that to happen, and then to run him down. And I just don't know that he's capable of doing that. I thought he really didn't have a whole lot of an excuse in the Derby. Granted, he broke out at the start, but he ended up in a good position, I thought, early on, and he just didn't stay. He faded away while Authentic and the others, like Tis the Law, went on with it. So, I understand again why they're running in the race. It's a grade one going two turns on dirt for 3-year-olds, and it's the last one. So yeah. You might as well do it. And, you know, he's had a pretty ambitious campaign, so I would think that, you know, unless he surprises me and runs a huge race, I would think that this might be, you know, the end of a long campaign for him, and then he'll get a nice rest and go down to Florida. I don't know. I mean, unless he won, I don't know that they'd be pressing on to try the Breeders' Cup Classic, but, you know, we'll see. But I don't know that back to your overarching question, I don't know that the race comes up well for him.
I do want to ask you, before we turn our attention toward Santa Anita and the weekend and some really interesting outcomes, Accession, Jay, and until he popped into this, he really has been out of sight, out of mind. But if we dial the clock back to March, he got beat by less than a length by Nadal, who, had Nadal gone on, would be one of the, you know, the serious lights of the 3-year-old division. Obviously this is a lot to ask, but he's got that look of a horse that clunks up for third or fourth at a big price.
Maybe to you, not to me. I mean, that race was completely a fluke by my way of looking at it. The pace was radioactive. You know, he got crazy fractions to run into, and the race shape, I think, flattered him. It was also an off track, which he might have liked.
True.
This is a pretty ambitious spot for a horse coming off of a layoff of this length, you know, for a trainer who's already got two others in here, and it just reads like, as we've seen often with Calumet, that they like to take shots in big races, and you know, we've seen it. We saw it in the Belmont with a horse who was completely overmatched, and this horse, you know, I would have liked to have think there might have been a more appropriate comeback spot for him, but if he wins, you know, congratulations to them, but he's not a use for me.
Yeah, you know, and I don't necessarily think that, you know, they're expecting him to stun. It, you know, it's just again, it's the last grade one. You know,
right.
All that. You know, and if he could be third, it's a feather in his cap. You know, he is by Union Rags, and he's a colt, and so forth, and you know, he's getting his season. He's already grade two placed, and so he's, you know, kind of think of this as the start of his 4-year-old campaign to some extent. The Preakness, 5:36 on Saturday. Obviously, we'll talk about it as the week continues. We'll check in with Marty McGee. I was going to go to broadcast Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and I cannot. I've got a Thursday eye follow-up, and they fit me in on a cancellation. So I will not get down to Baltimore, unfortunately. But we'll talk to Marty, who's on the scene again for what must be how many Preaknesses in a row must this be for Marty?
Quite a few. He you can ask him himself. But yes, he used to work for the Baltimore Sun, so he's well versed in the Preakness lore.
Exactly. And of course, the rest of the card, really good, with a lot of the 3-year-olds of short and long, turf and dirt, as I went through earlier this morning. Jay, let's turn our attention to the weekend at Santa Anita, which really did not disappoint. I I suppose we could do it chronologically, but I think instead we're going to do it by level of importance. Let's talk about the awesome again and a really impressive performance from Improbable.
Right. Well, like, you know, we had talked on Friday. I, you know, told you I thought the race just really came up well for him. I thought it was his race to lose with the way the race shape looked like it might unfold and with the way he'd been training. He's a much better horse now. I mean, he was a good horse as a three-year-old. But he's a much better horse now. And not that he needed help, but he certainly got a race that was made to order, the hot pace. They went the first six furlongs in 109.79, and he just sat back and inhaled them all on the turn and galloped off to victory. And he said that was his third straight grade one win, and his only loss was his first start of the year off of a layoff when he was wide the whole way, and the only horse who beat him that day was Tom Stittat, who's obviously one of the best older horses in the country. It'll be one of the top contenders for the Breeders' Cup Classic. So Improbable was a serious racehorse, and he's a good horse who didn't need the help, but he got some help as well, and it resulted in a 4.5-length victory that probably could have been even more if Drayden hadn't geared him down at the end.
Now, obviously on a nice roll here, and in much as we referenced with Authentic and Tis the Law arcing toward, Breeders' Cup showdown and or rematch or, you know, reagglomeration, the situation with Improbable, he definitely heads to Keeneland, you know, as, you know, the horse, not just the horse potentially to beat, but, with a chance to close out the season and you would assume be horse of the year and an older champion.
Yeah, if he wins that race, then I agree. He would be entitled to both of those Eclipse Awards for sure.
What's your read on Maximum Security? I talked to Baffert yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to hear it or if you talked to him subsequently after the recap of the race, but. And I'm not looking to make excuses, quote unquote, but it kind of does feel, Jay, that he is a horse that kind of likes things his own way.
I do think he wants he likes to have an easier pace than he got the other day. But
yeah,
I thought he ran a really good race in the context of what unfolded. The pace was really hot, and you know he fought off everybody but his very talented stablemate. But the other significant aspect of the race for me, or the performance for me, is that, you know, I'd said on your show last week, and I believe this, that I didn't think Maximum Security was training as sharply at Santa Anita into the Awesome Again as he did going into the Pacific Classic at Del Mar, exiting the San Diego. You know, he'd never raced at Santa Anita before. He had trained there before he went to Del Mar, and when he initially trained there, and when Baffert first got him, he was kind of an indifferent workhorse. And I don't know that that's his favorite track. And I think he's got a chance to run a lot better in his next start. Obviously, the pace of the race will be something to evaluate when we get there 5.5 weeks from now. But, you know, I wouldn't be dismissive of Maximum Security and think that he's on the other side of midnight or something like that right now. There's the way the race unfolded and that surface, I think, are reasons to believe that he didn't run up to as well as he's capable of on Saturday. So, you know, look, the Classic's going to come up a dynamite race. You've got Improbable, Tis the Law, Tom Stittat, you know, hopefully horses like Authentic and Art Collector, etc. It's going to be a really, really tough race. But I think Maximum Security is capable of running better than he did Saturday.
I agree. And a mile, you know, the mile and a quarter pace is going to be different than what transpired there. And I'm just amazed, and Andy's going to be on with me later, and I'm sure he'll admonish me for saying this again. But the rancor and the disdain that comes pouring out against this horse is really it's just exasperating. I'm not going to reiterate what I've said before, but it's like the eagerness to just to dismiss this horse at any opportunity is really remarkable.
I think the horse is a good horse, and I understand why people, based on what went on with his career as a 3-year-old and into the early part of this year, would be skeptical of some things about him. But I think he has subsequently shown that he's a top class horse who's a real fighter, and I admire the horse because I think he's got a lot of fight in him. I really do. He might not be the most naturally talented horse in the world. You watch a horse like Improbable Train, and it just comes a lot easier to him. But Maximum Security is just a bulldog when he gets into a tussle, and he's gutted out some wins like he did in the San Diego, and gutting out a second place finish the other day when lesser horses would have capitulated.
Let's do this by division, and so the companion race, the Zenyatta, with a win by Harvest Moon, and Simon Callahan, kind of laying in wait, it seemed, in there, and that was a nice performance by the Uncle Mo.
No, she's continued to make good strides. Lightly raced filly, 3-year-old against older, and just continued to go from strength to strength, and that was obviously a smart move on their part to run there. She's made good progress over the last few months, and it was a nice win. I didn't really see any excuse for Fighting Mad. I thought she just got beat on the square, and the race was hers to lose over a track that she likes with a pace scenario that was in her favor in a small field. So, it makes... There's been a lot of developments in the distaff in the last 48 hours that make that race a lot different than we thought it was going to be going into the weekend. Between that and, we'll wait to see what the status of Midnight Bijou is. And obviously we've got preps for that race coming up, with races like the Beldame and the Spinster coming up. So the complexion of the distaff is really in flux.
And, Baffert yesterday, for those that didn't hear, because I asked him about Fighting Mad, and, not that he was blaming Luis Saez at all, but he says what she needs to do is what, she had done in the Santa Maria and in the Hirsch, which is, kind of run them off their feet and have her speed used to her full advantage. And, Saez first time aboard. And Luis' specialty is to kind of rate on the front end and then try to spurt away, turning for home, because he's done it for us. I got two pictures I'm looking at above my desk. That's what he's best at, per se, but he might have learned a lesson. So I wouldn't be dismissive of Fighting Mad when we get to Keeneland. I wouldn't just gloss over her off that effort and think that that she's going the wrong way. Talk about the two turf events, Jay, and United is just, really good and really consistent, and Mandela beams when he's talking about this horse.
No, he's a really cool horse. He's just a galloper, and that race came up well for him. They were smart, just put him on the lead, and not worry about getting into traffic or letting another horse dictate the pace. And I thought it was the right move on his part. I mean, he's not a horse who's going to blow you away with a big turn of foot. He's just going to click off 12 after 12 after 12 after 12 and just keep on going. And he didn't get his chance really to do that in his prior race in the Del Mar Handicap, and they didn't leave anything to chance on Saturday in the John Henry and just let him be up on the lead and gallop around there. That's what he's good at. My concern with him going to Keeneland, and this will be a concern potentially for any horse who's just best on really firm ground, is just what the ground will be by the first weekend in November at Keeneland. The last time we had a Breeders' Cup there, we were well into fall, and the turf course was had some give in it. And I don't know that that that's going to benefit United. It might be fine for him, but it's an unknown.
Right. Right. And, of course, we'll see in the next couple of weeks what, you know, we don't really have much of a picture yet as to the European invaders that are targeting Keeneland. Talk about the Rodeo Drive, and had a fun visit with Tim Yakteen yesterday. That was an important win for Mucho, who, you know, they've been hoping for a great one for her and for the Krikorian and everybody involved. Nice win.
Very much so. I mean, I was down on her going into the race. I didn't think she had much of an excuse in her prior race against Calbreds, but you know, very similar to the race with United, they just put her on the lead in a paceless race, and she led from start to finish. It was a smart move on their part. I'm not sure she stacks up against the best in the country when it comes to Breeders' Cup time, but she's been a consistent filly on this circuit for a long time, and Tim's a terrific trainer, and they were smart in the way they handled her on Saturday, just put her right into the race, very much like United, and they got away with, look, the first eighth of that race is downhill, and they still ran the opening six furlongs in 1:14. So nobody was going to beat her after with a half mile to go when they go the first six in 1:14. Yeah, she ran her next quarter in 23 and her last quarter in 22.91. So good luck making an impact on a horse who's finishing like that off those soft fractions.
First grade one for Hernandez. Tim let it be known yesterday. And he's established himself in Southern Cal. Let's talk about the two-year-olds, Jay, and Peter Miller, who had a nice weekend. And we'll talk about CZ Rocket in a minute, as well as Bulletproof One. But get her number, the dialed-in son, Gary Barber. And Gary's been winning, seems like a major stake every weekend here for about 3-4 weeks. And yeah, this was a group that you kind of hinted that this was kind of a little bit of a potential grab bag.
Yeah, I'm not. I haven't been impressed overall with the 2-year-old males in California this year. I think the horses on the East are, you know, much superior to them right now. But you know, both Getter Number and Rumbauer, who ran second, had both run twice on grass at Del Mar, and with this opportunity, moved onto the dirt. It didn't look like it was a very deep field. I mean, the favorite is at even money is a horse who's never even won a race. So I thought it was a smart move on the likes of Miller and McCarthy to run those horses in this spot, and they ran 1-2. I don't know that these horses stack up as divisional leaders right now, but they ran good, strong races on Saturday, and it was their first dirt race, and perhaps they can continue to move forward off that. They certainly earned the right off that race to go on to the Breeders' Cup. The one thing that's significant about the American Pharoah to compare to something like the Champagne, for instance, is that the American Pharoah is a two-turn race.
Mm.
And I always think that when the Breeders' Cup is at a track where it's going to be a two-turn race, that success in a race like this is a lot more significant than a horse who, you know, runs into a fast pace and wins the Churchill Downs going a one-turn mile. I like to see a horse who does that at Churchill Downs come back and do well maybe in the Breeders' Futurity. That's the way I'm sort of looking at the American Pharoah. But I just haven't seen anything yet in California from a two-year-old standpoint that's wowed me. The horses out here got a... and probably everywhere else, a lot of them got a late start. They were on hold during the suspension of racing at Santa Anita. Trainers didn't know when racing at that point was going to start. As you know, all the sales were later than usual, and just people just didn't fill their orders and get horses into going at an earlier time, as early as they usually do. And I just think that's kind of impacted where things are at, for sure out here, and I would imagine elsewhere.
the girls' race, and we should mention, actually, that from a FIG standpoint, the 84, which is solid enough. There's a couple of, you know, there's a couple of two-year-olds that have run, you know, low 90s, but it's not, you know, it's not an eyesore by any means in terms of the FIG. Princess Noor, all she's done is win, and yet there seem to be some people, Jay, that are questioning her bona fides.
Well, I mean, let's look at it in a dispassionate way here. You know, her FIG was lower than got her number. And I think that's where a lot of the people who have poo-pooed her race are looking at it, as saying, like, look, what's the big deal? She's running in the upper 70s right now. But a couple of things, I think, to keep in mind here. First off, I think the track at Santa Anita might have gotten faster as the day went on. If you look at the fractions of the races for, you know, the Chandelier as compared to, you know, several hours later when they ran the American Pharoah, and then obviously older horses in the Awesome again, that's not a fair comparison, but I think the track was a little bit deeper earlier in the day. But the other significant thing to me regarding Princess Noor is that from her maiden win to the Del Mar debutante, she was coming back in just 15 days, and she was barely trained in between those two races just to keep refreshed and get through the race. And because of the scheduling of the Chandelier vis-a-vis the Del Mar debutante, she again was coming back on, you know, fairly short rest, just 19 or 20 days from that most recent start. And again, she had very light training going into this race because you just wanted to get through the race with her, and it didn't look like the field was going to be one that she was going to have to get to the be at her absolute best to prevail. I don't think the race came up. I don't think it unfolded to her favor early on in terms of where she was, and she still overcame that and won easily. I will say this: I think because of the way she's been trained from the maiden win to the debutante, and then again from the debutante to the Chandelier, those were just means to an end. Now, though, she's got 6 weeks to get ready for the Breeders' Cup, and I think you're going to see a horse who's going to be much more aggressively trained because she'll have the time in between starts to be trained the way Baffert likes to train horses for a race like that. And, you know, whatever she's capable of, whatever you've seen so far, she's going to run a lot better in the Breeders' Cup. And I'll give you a recent one, and it's a horse you even referenced earlier on today. After Nadal won his maiden race, he came back on short rest in the San Vicente. And, you know, he kind of gutted out a win that day, and there were people who were like, oh, he must not be as good as, you know, everybody's cracking him up to be. But it was a very similar situation to this. He was coming back on short rest, and they needed to get that race in to move him forward for his subsequent races in the Rebel and then, as it turned out, the postponed Arkansas Derby. And a very similar situation is going on here, in my belief, with Princess Noor, who just was trained lightly to get through these last couple races and now will be trained aggressively for her next start. And I think you're going to see a career best performance from her that day. Now, whether that's going to be good enough, you know, let's see. I haven't seen anything yet, emphasis on yet, from the two-year-old filly division back east.
Right,
That's fair. That scares me. You know, maybe something will pop up in the Frisette or the Alcibiades, but I haven't seen that yet. And that's why I said after the race the other day, I still think right now Princess Noor is the horse to beat in the juvenile fillies. And my opinion of that was formed by my, you know, understanding, my understanding of what was going on in terms of her training for her last two races and what's going to be happening going forward for her next race. So that's the prism in which, you know, I'm looking at her.
I appreciate it, and I wanted you to flesh it out. Couple of other spots. Let's talk about the sprint division over the weekend, and in the Chili, you had a nice nice win for the Y Gods and Cliff Seiss into chocolate under Umberto Rispoli and CZ Rocket, who Miller has dedicated to sprinting Jay and is really been at his best here and is a serious threat going forward toward the Breeders' Cup Sprint.
Right. I mean, I think he's certainly a top contender for the Breeders' Cup Sprint. You know, that division has also been thrown into chaos with Volatile having been retired. This is a horse who early on in his career looked like he was going to be a really serious sprinter, and it just looks like they kind of got away from what his best game was for a while, and he's just been, you know, now they focused on sprinting, and it certainly, you know, benefited him to be just focusing on sprints lately, and he's come back to the form that it looked like he had, you know, very early on in his career when he was a pretty highly regarded horse as a three-year-old. If you look at his lifetime PPs, it just looks like he was fed a steady diet midway through his career of races that, in hindsight, were just not really ideal for him. This is what's ideal for him is sprinting, and he's just a much better. He's much better doing this. That said, I'm really eager to see how a horse like Yalpon runs in the Chicklang on Friday at Pimlico, and obviously you've got Firenze Fire coming out of the Vosburgh win the other day, and then we'll see what happens at Keeneland. But you know, he's right in the mix right now in that division. The way it's kind of a jump ball, I think, for the male sprint title right now.
Yeah, and you gotta. We've not talked to Peter Miller about it, but you know, he was claimed for 40, and then it's not as if this has all happened overnight. He brought him back claimed him for 40, brought him back in a 50, then ran him in an allowance, ran him in a conditional allowance, then put him back into stakes company. And, these two grade two wins, it's kind of, it's pretty admirable the way this has been fashioned. And, what a tremendous claim for 40 Tom Cagle. Five straight. For CZ Rocket. And Jay, a couple of other spots, speaking of claims, was happy for Craig DeLazzi. Cupid's Claws, buried that Tokyo Cup field.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, like we talked on Friday, that race didn't really get my, you know, pulse racing. It's just, you know, it's a fun race to watch. You know, I'm glad that horses like that get that kind of opportunity, but, you know, when Combatant had won the Santa Anita, you know, handicap earlier this year, and then his subsequent races had been, you know, just so poor, and he was going to be one of the top contenders in that race. It was just hard to get excited, but it was nice to see Craig win that race. I mean, you know, Craig's done a good job for a long, long time, and it's nice to, you know, for him to get a win like that and see, you know, guys like him and Tim Yakteen. It's nice to see some different names get in the winner's circle around here.
Very much so. And I mentioned the Chili. You tabbed Big Renure into that Eddie D on Friday, and a nice win for Victor Garcia. And that started Hernandez's nice weekend.
Yeah, he had a great weekend. Big Renure, he was drawn right. He loves sprinting on the grass at Santa Anita, and he just ran those horses off their feet. So, I think he's a really top turf sprinter, and I think he would have a big chance in the Breeders' Cup. He's another one, though. I just don't know how he's going to handle a course that is going to be a lot different from the top of ground he gets at Santa Anita, and I don't know that he'll be as effective on that. So that's just something to weigh, but I'll worry about it 5.5 weeks from now.
Well, they got a lot out of the way over the 3 day Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and of course the cancellation of the weekend previous. And it was really fun. There was also some allowance action and so forth. Samantha Siegel with a winner. They're going to run. Well, we got the City of Hope and the Swing Time on Saturday. What else, Jay? This weekend.
Sunday, you've got the two-year-old races on the grass, the Zuma Beach and the Surfer Girl are the races.
Nice.
Those are local preps for the two-year-old Breeders' Cup grass races. So those are the types of horses that you'll see show up in those races. Those are on Sunday. The City of Hope Mile should be a good race. Sharp Samurai is going to go back to the grass for that after his big race in the Pacific Classic when he was second to Maximum Security. So he'll be among the headliners in that.
Excellent. Excellent. Jay, we covered a lot of ground. I appreciate it, and looking forward to wrapping up the Triple Crown coverage like we do every October.
Exactly, yes. Okay. The first Monday in October will be when the Supreme Court reconvenes, and when we wrap up, we have our post Triple Crown coverage, like we always do.
I love it, Jay. Enjoy Preakness. I appreciate the recap too on all of the Santa Anita action. I kind of laid off of it yesterday, other than the visits with Tim and Bob Baffert, because I was looking forward to doing a complete recap. So we got a lot done. I thanks for the visit.
No, my pleasure. And we'll look forward to some good racing this coming weekend.
Without a doubt. Jay Brivman, everybody. DRF Brivman on your Twitter dial. We're going to stay here, and we're going to welcome in Dr. Dan Brown. And Santa Anita's still on the docket for conversation, but slightly different. And the conversation, and you'll recall that Santa Anita and the Stronach Group, at the time of the analysis and the postscript to the issues that created the spate of injuries and fatalities, one of the dedicated decisions was to enhance diagnostic capability for the racetrack practitioners and for the regulatory vets and essentially, give the horsemen a hand by bringing in the most modern technology available to racetracks and essentially to the equine industry. And they turned to Hallmark, that uses imagery, essentially, the same MRI technology that that human, not just human athletes, human any human anything. So the MRI technology that the walk-in unit, the standing MRI technology that's been added as part of the diagnostics, should really advance this whole frame of approach to diagnosing horses before issues get, very tenuous. And very pleased that Dr. Dan Brown can join us. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
Doc, I have talked a little bit over the years about the MRI technologies and what they provide racetrack practitioners and attending veterinarians. Talk about what the unit itself, what the machinery gives veterinarians, what they get to see that they wouldn't otherwise.
Sure, yeah. So I work for Hallmark. We make this standing MRI unit, and it's the only standing MRI unit available for equine patients. And to just give you a little background on what MRI is, it's essentially the use of a very strong magnet to detect the location of water within the body. So we can tell if there's water in an abnormal place, then that's likely to be a problem. It can indicate things like fractures or inflammation or disruption to tendons and ligaments, for example. And as I say, this system that we have was developed about 20 years ago by a horse owner and and MRI physicist, Dr. Nick Bolas. And he decided that the status quo at that stage, which was you had to have a horse put under general anesthesia to have an MRI, was something that needed changing. So he set about developing a standing MRI unit. And with this system now, we can lead the horse into the room, lightly sedate it, scan anywhere from the foot up to the carpus in the front leg and up to the hock in the hind leg. And really, as you said, MRI is used in a wide variety of applications in human medicine, from sports injuries to neurology to oncology. And the reason why it has such a wide-ranging application is because it's pretty unique in the fact that it can image both soft tissues, so tendons, ligaments, etc., and the bony tissues. And on top of that, it images not just the anatomy, so you can see the edge of that bone, the outline of that tendon, but also the physiology. So as I mentioned before, by being able to image where there is water within the body, we can actually image physiological processes such as inflammation.
How does this differ, the MRI imagery, how does it differ from, you know, what has been used conventionally, you know, the smaller, you know, scan units that, you know, you see vets use, you know, a lot of times there's somebody, a few people at racetracks that'll come around and do a scan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, typically the handheld units or the portable units that we're thinking of would be either X-ray or ultrasound. And X-ray obviously has been around for years and years and is very, very good at imaging the structure of bones. So that's the primary application for X-rays. If you think you might have a fracture, you're going to get an X-ray probably initially to try and find that fracture. The downside of X-rays is that it's not very good at imaging soft tissue. So that's where the other handheld modality, if you like, comes in, and that's ultrasound or ultrasonography. And ultrasonography fires sound waves, not radiation, but sound waves, into the tissue that you wish to image, and then, if you like, listens for the echoes coming back and creates an image out of that. And that, in contrast to X-ray, ultrasonography is very, very good for imaging soft tissues, whereas it's not very good at all for bony tissues, because the sound waves don't penetrate that. So ultimately, you have two different modalities there that both have their strengths, but there's not much overlap between the two. Some of the newer modalities, the three-dimensional imaging modalities that we've seen come on in the last few years, include things like MRI, PET scanning, like CT, and the other one that's obviously very common around racetracks is nuclear medicine. So that's or bone scan, as it's known. And bone scan and PET are fairly similar in that they work by injecting radioactive material into the body and then attaching it to a molecule that goes for a certain target site. So in racehorses, the target site would be bone that is either damaged or being regenerated. So that radioactivity locates itself and concentrates at sites of bone turnover and bone change. So, and then you can image that and you can say, okay, there's a hot spot. That's where something's going on with the bone there.
It lights up essentially, and this
exactly.
this is the challenge. It's those micro, you know, what Dr. Alday would describe as a micro fracture, and mm-hmm. it doesn't show up immediately. The horse might not even present as being off. It's that innocuous But the minute there's that vulnerability, all the variety of outside influences can then exploit it. Having this right. equipment and having this technology and you know this this imagery opportunity, it basically just advances everybody's diagnosis capabilities.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, it's an early warning system.
Yes.
It allows us to detect these changes earlier, and the implication of that being that the earlier you detect the problem, the less damage has been done, so treatment is easier, and you get better outcomes in a shorter period of time. So it's win, 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 win all the way down the line, really. Previously, our identification of these patients, these horses, has tended to be fairly reactive. You know, it's either been a horse that has become quite obviously lame, or unfortunately, the first thing you know about it might be that it has a catastrophic fracture during training or during a race. It is important to understand the process that leads to this. It used to be thought that this was a bad step disease, catastrophic fractures, and that's certainly known not to be the case now. It may be that one bad step is the last link in the chain, but as you mentioned, microfractures due to repetitive overload are what's going on and what has been going on during the many, many training and racing cycles before that. And in the live horse, there is no way to specifically image microfractures. You can do it in post-mortem sections of bone using a technique called micro-CT, but in the live horse, there is nothing with enough resolution to actually see microfractures themselves. An x-ray, for example, it needs the bone density to change by about 40% before you can even start to see a wow. difference in between a normal and an abnormal x-ray. And that, obviously, 40% change is 40% damage, and that's a lot. The way MRI helps with this is it does the next best thing to actually being able to image the microfractures, which is that it images the fluid that is caused by the microfractures. So these microfractures occur, and these are occurring in all horses in training and in work. The horses that go on to have problems are the ones where the rate of microfracture exceeds the rate of repair. So there's a normal turnover. A bone is an active living substance. It's not just like a leg on a table, which is just static and doesn't change. So when these microfractures happen, small amounts of fluid are released into the bone. And going back to what I said about MRI right at the beginning, one of the things that MRI can do that no other imaging modality can do is see that fluid. So that's really what we're looking for. Is there an abnormal amount of fluid in a normally, essentially fluid-free bone?
A couple of follow-up elements. You mentioned bone density, and how much mapping is possible, and is there a comparative element to this to see if a specific horse, if there's been changes in the landscape of the horse? Is there a way to compare? Do you compare them the way you compare radiographs and the like?
Yes, you certainly can do. Each horse is different, which is one of the aspects that presents a problem with this. If they were all the same and we could sort one out, we could sort them all out. So essentially, to compare in a meaningful way, you need to compare imaging, whether it's MRI or X-ray or CT or PET, imaging of that horse over time to see how that particular horse is changing. And you rightly identified bone density as one of the things that we look at. And in fact, without MRI, that's the key thing that you can look at is bone density. And the analogy that's been used is that horses will always lay down more bone when they're in training. It's just a way of strengthening the bone in response to the stress. But the analogy that's been used is that when too much bone gets laid down, it stops being able to absorb the stresses so much. So it becomes less like a sort of a green stick and able to flex, and it becomes more like a glass rod where it becomes stiff and doesn't flex, and if you apply too much force, it just shatters. So that's where bone density comes in. But the flip side of that, as I say, we're particularly interested in with MRI is the fluid accumulation. So bone density increase to a certain extent is normal, but fluid accumulation really, to any appreciable extent, isn't normal. So from that, we're using fluid presence more as a sensitive indicator of actual damage to try and differentiate, and it's tricky, but to try and differentiate between normal physiologic responses to training and then maladaptive pathological responses to changes to training, which are likely to cause injury and or breakdown.
What you just described too, as part of the strengthening and the conditioning element, is that what's happening when a horse gets, when a particularly a young horse gets shinny and starts the, you know, start the shins, when you hear, you know, a trainer say, you know, the baby's got some shins, and is that essentially what is going on?
Yeah, pretty much all of the bone problems in racehorses are this repetitive stress injury manifesting in some way. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And it's really, and you can explain this too. I mean, Dr. Alday's for years, as we've stressed this, you know, the misnomer or the misunderstanding that people seem to have when you hear them say, oh, we shouldn't be racing these horses at two. It's the exact opposite. They have to be stressed at a young age. That will guarantee and gives you the best opportunity for longevity and strengthening the bone. But it's got to be there's a happy medium. I mean, it can't be done all at once. This is where horsemanship comes in.
Right. Yes, exactly. I've heard Dr. Larry Bramlage say on numerous occasions that in the horse, it is the skeleton that needs training the most. And you know, that's very different from human athletes. Our weakness seems to be our cardiovascular system. So that's what, when we train, we try to train for cardiovascular endurance. The horse is already equipped with an incredibly capable cardiovascular system, and it's the skeleton really that lets it down in the untrained horse. So you're absolutely right. You have to train these horses' bones to be able to carry around their heart and lungs without failing. And the amount of training that's right for horse A may be different from the amount of training that's right for horse B. They have a natural ability to repair this damage, and that the rate that they can repair this damage varies horse by horse, just like individual talent will vary and height will vary and mane color will vary. It's all individually variable. And one of the things that we can do, going back to this longitudinal imaging technique, is if we get a baseline, if we get a time zero image of the horse, we can see what's going on. We can actually go back and monitor that horse over time and really fine-tune that individual's training to what we want. And if we see things happening that we don't want, such as the accumulation of fluid, which is otherwise known as a bone bruise in the bone. If we see that, we know that horse, that individual, may need to be backed off a bit. And that's the good news of all this, is that most of these changes are reversible up to a point. Obviously, when they fracture, when they get a really horrible pod lesion, it may have gone too far. But going back to what I said before, if we use this early warning system, we detect them earlier. All we have to do is pull them out of fast work for a certain amount of time, and the body will do its job. the bone will regenerate and adapt, and then they can go back into training.
And that's it. I'm thrilled that you've kind of circled back to that, because that was my ham-handed question about the tracking and having a series of images that that can track progress and track the direction the patient A is going. Let's talk some of the specifics. Dr. Dan Brown with us, who pretty much heads up the MRI, the standing MRI unit and initiatives at Hallmark. It's Hallmark with a Q, and they kind of not only is it a standing MRI, they stand alone. They're pretty much the not just the leaders. They're alone on the lead when it comes to this. Hallmark with a Q.net. Dr. Brown, talk about how many horses in a day can go through the unit, and the practicalities of screening horses on a daily basis, and the opportunity to figure out who is potentially susceptible, who are the at-risk horses, or is there a scenario where you can run a whole field of horses 48 hours out, or how can we utilize this to best advantage to keep at-risk horses off the racetrack?
Sure, yeah. So the process for putting a horse through the MRI, as I touched on earlier, is it's a mild sedation. The horse walks in, it stands in the magnet, and if you go to our website at hallmark.net, there are pictures of horses there actually undergoing scans. There are also videos on YouTube. The horse stands with the leg to be imaged within a sort of C-shaped magnet, and the other leg just outside the C. And typically, for a racehorse fetlock scan, you're looking at somewhere between 45 and 60 minutes to complete that scan. And anyone that's been for an MRI themselves will know it takes that sort of time to that order of magnitude to scan a human in MRI as well. It just feels like a lot longer because of the claustrophobia aspect. With the horses, of course, it's only the foot that's in the magnet, so they do very, very well with this. The sedation is extremely light, because what we don't want is them to be sedated to the point where they're swaying, because motion is our enemy. So we want them just the edge taken off enough so that they're able to stand there quietly. We have one person on the head of the horse, just keeping them calm and monitoring them, making sure that they're comfortable and they're not getting too deep or too light with the sedation. And the other person, excuse me, is a trained operator who sits at the computer screen and actually runs the scans. So, like I say, they're in maybe 10 to 15 minutes to get the sedation settled, 45 to 60 minutes of actual scanning, and then they're turned around, walked out, and they can go back to their stall and just recover as they would do for any other sedation. In fact, it's probably one of the lightest sedation applications in equine veterinary medicine. So with that being the case, you could probably comfortably do four horses a day at a unit. And the beauty, of course, of the Santa Anita system is that it is right there on the track. So those horses are all within walking distance of the MRI. Now, you mentioned about you asked about the application of this to screening large volumes of horses. Obviously, if you've got 2,000 horses in training and you can do four a day, you're not going to be able to do them all monthly, for example. So some form of pre-selection needs to happen. And that's where certainly at Santa Anita, the different groups of veterinarians at the track, the private practitioners, the regulatory vets, the Stronach group's own vets that are there, they all work together, and each horse gets seen multiple times a week by multiple vets. And essentially, any one of those vets that has any index of suspicion about a particular horse can decide to recommend going for advanced imaging, of which MRI is one of the primary types. The other question you asked, I think, was about screening or looking at horses just before a race. That is possible, certainly. They will recover, physically they'll recover from the sedation very quickly. The only note of caution there is that there are banned substances, there are, sedative and pain-killing drugs that go into that sedation. So what we don't want to do is push it so close to the race that you end up with a drug test positive, of course.
Well, and it's, I mean, to that degree, it's very similar. You probably, they get like a little bit of ACE, to just some ACE promazine, to, like they do when they get the farrier. You know, the guys, there's plenty of horses that won't, that are unhappy getting shod, and also, for the dentist, when the dentist comes to float and so forth.
Yeah.
You give them a little ACE take the edge off.
It would be a similar use of sedation. So, yeah, ACE promazine, butorphanol potentially, and some of the alpha-2 agonists like dormacedin, for example, would be another one that's commonly used in the MRI application. But, yeah, very, very similar to all those applications you mentioned.
Well, a couple of the practical elements of this as well. Dr. Dan Brown with us from Hallmark. How many of these machines are in the United States right now?
We have 30 in North America, and the Santa Anita one is the only one actually at a racetrack. Most of them are in either a private practice or some of them are at university vet schools. For example, UC Davis has one of our standing MRI systems. Most of the other ones outside Santa Anita are doing more of the sport horse applications, so show jumpers, dressage, hunters, etc.
That's interesting too. That is there one within a reasonable distance of every racetrack in the country, or are there parts of the country and I think about a place like down at Belmont, for instance, with the Ruffian Center. Is there one within reach pretty easily of all racetracks?
Sadly, not all racetracks, no. You mentioned the Ruffian Center, which is obviously just over the road from Belmont, and they do have one of our systems. We currently have a system just up the road from, I think it's about an hour away from Pimlico. Sadly, we don't have one in Kentucky. So if there's any veterinarians in Kentucky that are interested in looking into standing MRI for down there, I'm sure we could definitely provide an answer for that need. So the short answer is no, not all tracks have this within easy reach at the moment, but it's something that we would definitely like to see. And I think the study that's going on at Santa Anita and our experience in other places around the world where we do have them on or very near tracks, including Newmarket in England, with the Hong Kong Jockey Club's got one, Japan Racing Association has two systems. So we have a wealth of data about this utilization in racehorses, and we're definitely seeing a lot of benefits in all those places.
How much is a unit?
Well, we have several different business models, actually. Typically, if you wanted to buy it, it comes within its own modular building, so you just need to pour a concrete pad, and it comes delivered and is placed there. That's round about $750,000. We also have the opportunity to rent them or lease them and pay per scan. So we can usually find a solution for most people that have the caseload to justify one of these systems.
Well, to be honest, the thing is priceless, because of course every horse that gets preventative diagnosis and is kept out of the potential of a catastrophic incident. It's you know, it pays for itself in saving the horse and the owner and trainer and the industry. I mean, it whatever expenses involved here it is worth it times 10.
That's right, and really, I mentioned the case volume before. That's really the key. It's as all MRI systems are. It's not a cheap imaging modality, but if you can spread it over a large number of patients, then it becomes very manageable in terms of cost. And then, as you said, in terms of the benefit it can bring, I'm glad you said priceless, because if I'd have said it, that would have just been me being a sales guy. So we'll leave that as your word.
I love it. I love it. And Dr. Hallmark is based where in the U.S.?
In the U.S., our headquarters is in Chicago, which is where I'm sitting right now. And then our global headquarters is in England, in southeast England, close to London.
And again, I will direct people to Hallmark. It's with a Q. It's not Hallmark, M-A-R-K, M-A-R-Q, HALLMARQ.net. Dr. Dan Brown, and Doctor, I really appreciate this, and of course, you know, the dedication here of the Stronach Group and the Dolly Green Research Foundation as well, the Southern California Equine Foundation. There were a lot of entities that made this happen to get the unit at Santa Anita, and will serve as a great example for you know,
yeah,
for the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great to see all these different entities come together to make this happen, and also, as well as several individuals. There are some pretty sizable donations from individuals to get this standing equine MRI system onto the track at Santa Anita, and we're very grateful that it's been able to happen.
Outstanding. We're grateful for the visit, and any innovation or, you know, any further discussion and Q&As, we'll get you back on. I appreciate it, Dr. Brown.
Yes, please do. You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Not at all. Dan Brown, everybody. Hallmark Veterinary Imaging, and the first of its kind on a racetrack. I mean, it's at equine hospitals and clinics around the country. I'm actually 30 was a big number. I was impressed with that number in North America. Let's take our last break of the morning. We've had a lot to do. Andy Serling is going to join us next. And I've got to get Kelly, too. I wanted to get Kelly Breen in here. So, I mean, it's like planes over O'Hare, as we say. Back after this, Andy joins us.
Racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the Races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Vick. Horse racing, handicapping.